time for us to begin. It's so good to see all of you this evening, see your interest in the things that we're trying to discuss. We've been discussing the history and geography of the Bible, about 2 years. But the point being is that we've not been talking about exactly the same thing. We've followed the scheme of redemption through Old Testament history, and now we are in the period of time between the Testaments. How long was that period of time, Bruce, between the Old and the New Testament?
400 years, yes.
400 years. What was the condition that existed among the people of God, David, when the Old Testament closed? The book of Malachi. What was the condition of the people of God when the Old Testament closed? Malachi addresses that. That's right. They were very indifferent, apathetic towards the things that God had commanded of them, offering the sick, the blind, the lame, so forth, and even then saying, oh, what a weariness it is. And they were instructed to offer that to their governors and see if they would accept that. In previous studies, we have examined the prophecy of Daniel, and we've referred to that recently in several classes. And Daniel, in Daniel chapter 2, prophesied about the coming of the Lord's kingdom. He prophesied that it would be during the period of time identified as the last days. He was speaking those things to King Nebuchadnezzar. And he identified the image that King Nebuchadnezzar saw. This is Daniel chapter 2, beginning about verse 16 and the next several verses. He told Daniel that in this image that you saw, you saw a head of gold, you saw chest and arms of silver, you saw belly and thighs of brass, and the legs were of iron, the feet were part iron and part clay. And he said, you saw that image until there was a small stone that was cut out of the mountain and smote that image on the feet, and it all fell. And the application or the interpretation that Daniel gave to that image that King Nebuchadnezzar saw was, thou art the head of gold. Now, just immediately, that tells us something. What is the image representing? All right, it's representing King Nebuchadnezzar and his kingdom. Now, the fact that Daniel says, thou art the head of gold, identifying King Nebuchadnezzar as the beginning place, reigning over his kingdom, the kingdom of Babylon, what do we know that the rest of that image must be?
Future kingdoms.
Future kingdoms. That's right. He told King Nebuchadnezzar, after you, there's going to be another one. And after that, there's going to be another one. And after that, there's going to be a fourth kingdom. Now, being familiar with both biblical history as well as secular history, we know that the kingdom that conquered the Babylonian Empire was what? Now, this is Bible history. The Medes and the Persians. And Cyrus, the king of that empire, wrote a decree allowing the people of God to go home. And the people of God did go home. They rebuilt the temple. They rebuilt under the leadership of Nehemiah the walls around the temple. And we note also that as they resumed their sacrifices, they had become very indifferent and apathetic about those sacrifices. Now, they had not engaged in the worship of idols, but here's where they are. In time, we see that the Syrian Empire rose to a position of power. But before we get to that, we start with the Babylonian Empire. The next was the Persian Empire. Then what did we have? The Greek Empire, and then the fourth empire was the Roman kingdoms. That's right. Now, what we want to see is in this sequence of kings, events that happen. Now, we've talked about it all the way up to the close of the Old Testament. And Bruce has noted that that was a period of time before the New Testament began, 400 years. And when we look at the history of the United States, how old is it? 220-30-something years, can you, in studying United States history, see a lot of changes that have taken place? Well, you see a lot of economic changes, a lot of political changes, a lot of cultural changes, even a lot of land barrier or boundaries changing during that period of time. Do we not also think that such things occurred during Bible times? Well, they did, yes. Now, for a record of those things, we can't turn to the Bible because we're talking about the period of time between the Old Testament and the New Testament. But we can study secular history and know a great deal about what happened during these interim years, 400 years between the Old Testament and the New Testament. Now, just to, as we say, make a long story short, we know that an empire known as the Syrian, now I'm not talking about the Assyrian, but much, much later in history, the Syrian Empire. It began to grow, but it was nothing to compare with the great Babylonian Empire or the Assyrian Empire that was before that. And certainly not the Alexandrian or Greek Empire that preceded them. But during the days of Alexander the Great, what was one of the things that he desired to accomplish? Fact is, alright, he wanted to have a Greek culture. Over all that he had dominated, he wanted to establish a Greek culture. Now, we've talked about the various aspects of that. It meant to change their language to Greek. It meant to change their culture to Greek. And so he began to establish model cities that were Grecian and to change their religion. Now, I'm not an expert on that, but I am told that when you change those three things, you've just about conquered the people that you rule over. You have dominated them. But to some degree, some of that was good as far as the spreading of the gospel is concerned. Now, we've talked about the translation of the Old Testament scriptures into the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament scriptures, which tells us that the Old Testament had been brought together and compiled as scripture. So that we use the word canonized, the Old Testament. We know what was authenticated as a part of the Old Testament when it was translated into the Greek language. And that called the Septuagint. When we look into the New Testament and we read of the quotations of the Lord and quotations often of the inspired writers of the New Testament, what language does it appear they're quoting from? The Greek language, which tells us that the Septuagint translation, the Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament, was in use during first century times and approved by the Lord and by the New Testament apostles and prophets because that's what they quoted from. And it was understood during that time throughout the empire. Now, when Syria began to grow and to dominate, it was their desire to dominate all the way through the land of Canaan and on down into Egypt. But there was a fly in the butter, and that was Jerusalem and the temple that was there. Because the Jews were at that point faithful to the Lord. They were not interested in worshiping the idols. They were not interested in serving the Greek gods or forming Greek culture. And so consequently, the Syrians began to threaten the city of Jerusalem. Now, we've talked about John Hyrcanus and how that he led the Maccabees in delivering the city of Jerusalem and restoring the temple and driving back the Syrians back farther north from where they came. Now, we note that John Hyrcanus was eventually killed. And the day, as we see on the board, of the great Maccabees came to an end. decades followed. And Saul, of course, much like many kingdoms that exist today and even existed during Bible times, where you have someone who obtains a position of greatness, but his greatness might be challenged by his generals, and so you have division for power. And, of course, one of the things that we've noted already is that the various groups of the Jews have now begun to form. The Pharisees, who were they?
They looked at themselves as the keeper of the law.
That's right. And often they stood up so straight, as we've used the expression, they leaned over backwards. Now we've got a pendulum swing here. From the days of Malachi to a time of very great indifference and apathy, swung now to a group among the Jews that makes laws where God didn't make them. Just to see how strict they were, the law said that they were not to work on the Sabbath, they were not to gather wood, they were not to light a candle. And so consequently, the Pharisees had made a law that they would not open a door that might flame or fan the flame of the candle, lest they be considered doing work on the Sabbath day, violating the Sabbath. What did God say, that they were not to open the door that might shed some breeze on the candle? No, it didn't say that. It said that they were not to light a fire. Now, understanding that, you see how that they had interpreted the law and made it much more strict than God had made it. And, as we see in Matthew the 15th chapter, they were binding various washings upon the apostles, in particular, washing their hands before you eat. Now, that's a good idea, but God didn't legislate that. It's a good idea, but God did not legislate that.
Didn't Jesus tell them that the Sabbath was made for men, not men for the Sabbath?
He did, yes, he said that. And he also told them that by binding these traditions, they were making void the commandments of God. And we see that in Matthew chapter 15. But what we want to see is, as a result of some of these divisions within the existing empire, you see somewhat of a civil war that is taking place in the land. And as we study further about this Maccabean revolt, we note that John Hyrcanus died, and his son, Aristobulus, determined that he was going to be the king. Now, we got a problem. When it concerns the king of God's people, who did God say was going to be king? Those of the lineage of David. That's right. Here's what God had established. Well, we got a problem now with the son of Hyrcanus. He is not of the lineage of David. And others saw it as having independence and the beginning of a new day of glory for Israel. Some saw that here we've got a king now, so perhaps it's going to be like it was during the days of the major kings of Israel, during the days of David and Solomon. Now, when you have such different views and such different practices, you see that the people of God, if I may coin the expression, we're all messed up. They were divided. They were following different leaders. Their priests had changed. And so there's a lot of things that are not right among the people of God. Now, we have noted earlier that one of the things that Rome was doing was pretending to be a friend to Israel. Now, Rome way over here, Israel down here, Syria up here. If I turn the right way, you'll have that north and south. But understanding that, when the Jews were fighting against the Syrians, Rome is just sitting over here waiting. Now, when the Jews fought against the Syrians, obviously they killed a whole bunch of the Syrians. In fact, during the reign or the leadership of John Hyrcanus, we see that there were thousands upon thousands of Assyrians that were killed. What would that do to their army? Well, it would weaken it, obviously. And so Rome is just sitting over here waiting for an opportunity. Now, when you've got the Syrians pushed back and weakened, and you've got the Israelites down here indicating some measure of independence, though they are divided among themselves, what does Rome do?
Take advantage of
just jumps all over that.
Yeah. Because it was Rome's desire to control the whole area around the Mediterranean Sea, all of it. I'm told back up to at least 50 miles inland. It was their desire to control all of it. Now, if they did that, what would they control? All right. Commerce, trade routes, yes. What would that make Rome?
Rich.
World power. That's right. And so that's what they desired to be. Now, Pompey invaded the country and brought it under Roman domination. Now, we want to see how that transpires. We're going to study that in our next lesson. But the Maccabean rulers accomplished a number of things. They drove out their enemies, and they conquered many of the ancient enemies as well. Samaria was conquered, and the temple on Mount Gerizim was destroyed. We talked about how that was built and why it was built. The Samaritans believed in God, but they had equated God as just another idol, and so they built a temple to worship God in Mount Gerizim. But that was not with a clear understanding of who God really is. Here are some of the old enemies. The Edomites, the Idumeans, were conquered and forced to accept Jewish religion. And this is going to become very important to us a little bit later. But another point that I want us to note just here that's going to be real important to us when we start into the New Testament is that the lineage of Herods, the family of Herod, they were Edomites. They were not Jewish. Now, there's a reason for me to say that. Let me just throw this out and you consider it. When we read in Matthew chapter 14 and in Mark chapter 6 about John's rebuke of Herod, he said, it's not lawful for you to have your brother's wife. Well, some will say it was not lawful because the law forbade incest. Now, though Herod may have adopted many of the things of the law, he was not a Jew. He was an Idumean. And so he was not obliged to keep the law of Moses. Do we see that? So John's rebuke of Herod, it is not lawful for thee to have her, is not just simply wrong because of incest. It was wrong because it was contrary to God's law governing the marriage relationship from the beginning. That's right. And when John told Herod that, and Herodias, his wife, it cost John his head. He beheaded him and delivered his head to his wife, delivered John's head to his wife on a silver platter. Yes.
I thought incest had to be blood relative.
Well, go back, if you will, to, is it Leviticus chapter 21? We can resolve that, I suppose, if I can find a passage. Leviticus 18 or Leviticus 16 verses 20 and 21. I knew that was in there somewhere. Leviticus 16 verses 20 and 21. Do you have that, Randy?
Yeah. 16:20 doesn't have anything to do with that. We finished the toning for the holy place and kind of meeting.
No, that doesn't. All right, let me try another. Leviticus 18, yes. Yes, that's what I'm looking for, Leviticus 18. Let's see, regarding incest. Anyone of near kin to him, verse 6. Not necessarily, I don't think, a blood relative, but someone kin to him.
New American Standard says blood relative.
Blood relative, there you go.
No unusual approach any blood relative of his to whichever nakedness.
Okay. The nakedness of thy father's wife, thou shalt not uncover. The nakedness of thy sister, the daughter of thy father, or the daughter of thy mother, whether born at home or born abroad, even their nakedness thou shalt not uncover. The nakedness of thy son's daughter or thy...
Verse 16.
Thou shalt not uncover the nakedness of thy brother's wife. There you are.
Well, I just thy brother's make this point that it seems strange that somebody would make the argument that Jesus was telling him not to commit incest. It's not really incestual, it's just... It's just immoral because you're taking your brother's wife.
Well, the argument is flawed, is what I'm trying to establish here. The argument is flawed. It wasn't that it was incest that caused John to rebuke him. It was because he had taken someone he had no right to. His brother's wife or your wife. He had no right to her. And so consequently, John rebuked him. I like to ask the question when I talk about that. Somebody said, well, it was only incest that was wrong. Well, it would it have been all right if he'd had your wife?
No.
Well, no. No, that wouldn't be all right. Well, why not? Because that's contrary to God's law from the beginning.
She's already somebody else's wife. Yeah.
Go figure on that. So here we are. Now, that answers, I think, to some degree, at least your question. But what I want us to see is the application of noting who the Herods were. They were not Jewish. They were not under the law. They had become Jews only in their religion, but not in their lineage, of course. They were Idumean. Now, as we think of some closing remarks here on this period of the Maccabees, we want to look and see some key areas from the Maccabean period. We know that the the city of Samaria, I'll say that in a minute, was conquered and the temple of Mount Gerizim was destroyed. That makes Samaria a very important place to our study in preparation for our New Testament study. We know that the old Edomites or Idumeans, as the Greeks called them, were conquered and forced to accept the Jewish religion. And this point, of course, becomes important, as we have mentioned. The city of Jerusalem is important because this was the city for which the Maccabees fought. And, of course, we saw how that the leader traveled to Modin and then eventually conquered Beth-Zur. And all these places then you see on this map become important to our study. I want to talk with you about some other things this evening, unless you have a question about this Maccabean period. Now, I do want to note with you some things that occurred during this Maccabean period. And let me just shut that off for a moment. Maybe not. There we go. I mentioned to you some source material for you to read that would be helpful to you in studying what happened during this interim period. You remember we talked about 1st and 2nd Maccabees. Now, if you have a Bible that or a program on your computer that has several Bibles, you might find the Dewey Rheims Bible. That is the Catholic Bible. And it includes books that are not considered to be inspired. But yet these books do record some rather interesting history. And we talked about the books of 1st and 2nd Maccabees as it relates to the period of the Maccabees. Yes?
I've been trying to figure out, where are the Maccabees in the Bible? I mean, is there a...
You won't find them in the Bible.
Okay.
Because they're in that intertestamental period between the Old Testament and before the New Testament during that 400 years. So you won't find them in the Bible. We have to look at secular history to find out what happened during those 400 years. And what we're trying to do is to set the stage for the development of New Testament times in fulfillment of the prophecy of Daniel to establish these four empires that are going to develop, and of course, resulting in the reign of the Romans, during which time the New Testament picks up, John the Baptist begins to preach, and Jesus begins to preach, and then the apostles begin to preach, and we're going to look at the text quite extensively when we get to that point. But all I know that we can do is to note that this period existed.
More questions?
Sure.
And why do you say Maccabees 1 and 2?
Well, in our biblical studies, we've noted books like Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. We say, well, they're giving different perspectives on the same history. And when we talk about 1 and 2 Kings and 1 and 2 Chronicles, we know that there are different perspectives from the writers relative to the same kings. And we've got a lot of different names that identify the same man when we compare those accounts. But 1 and 2 Maccabees is not one continual history. It is a restatement often of the same history. And that's just what it's called in these history accounts, 1 and 2 Maccabees. You may be reading about some events that occurred during the duration of the same time frame in both of these accounts. Now, we know that this period existed because of our New Testament study. We know that Jesus observed the Feast of Dedication. Now, that's just a little blip on this 400-year period, especially the period of the Maccabees, or the latter, probably about the latter third. Because what we learn in the Feast of Dedication, that feast was a feast that was to celebrate the cleansing of the temple as these Maccabean people removed the Syrians who had polluted the temple, defamed the temple by offering swine on the altar and getting rid of the priesthood and just a lot of other things. And so when John Hyrcanus began to chase them out of the city and purify the temple and so forth, the Jews had a great big celebration. And it was called the Feast of Dedication. Jesus celebrated that. I have to look at my notes to see exactly what passage that's in. It's in the book of Luke, I believe. Someone have that for me? That would be most helpful. John 10. It's in John. John chapter 10. John chapter 10, verses 22 and 23. John chapter 10, verses 22 and 23. Pardon me? Yes, please.
At the time of the Feast of Dedication took place at Jerusalem, it was winter and Jesus was walking in the temple in the porch of Solomon. And the Jews gathered around him, and they were saying to him, How long will you keep us from suspense? If you are the Christ, then tell us when.
All right, let's pause right there. The point we're looking for is that in New Testament times, we read of the Feast of Dedication in the city of Jerusalem. You know what that celebration has today by Jews? Hanukkah. Now, that's where that came from. During this period of intertestamental period, when the Maccabees drove the Syrians out of the temple and out of Jerusalem and cleansed the temple and began to restore these sacrifices, they celebrated. And that became then a yearly celebration, today known as Hanukkah. But we see that Jesus observed that feast here in John chapter 10. And that gives us reference to this period of the Maccabees. Yes.
I'm just thinking, it doesn't really say he observed it. It just mentions that it was taking place.
Well, that's the point. He was in Jerusalem during this time, and as a Jew, which he was, it would be likely that he was observing their feast day.
I guess the reason I called it into question is because it wasn't commanded.
No, it was not. He may or may not. That's not the point.
Yeah.
The point is, it exists. And we can read about it in the New Testament. And it existed during the life of Jesus. And he was in the city of Jerusalem when it was taking place.
I have a question, too.
All right.
I haven't really... I, I've looked through the Maccabees before. We have the Apocrypha. I haven't had a chance to look at it recently. Is there any mention in that or any of the other apocryphal books about the Pharisees and the Sadducees? Is that something that
I'd have to look. If you'd like, I've got it up here and I can do a search.
I'm just curious.
Yeah. I'll do a search and find it right quick.
That's the other thing, that we don't find any Pharisees or Sadducees in the Old Testament.
Oh, no. No.
They pick it up immediately in the New Testament.
Well, they are in the New Testament. Right. But when they started, from what I understand, it was during this intertestamental period, during the tail end of it, as the people of the Jews began to have this discord among them. What created that discord was some wanted to hold to the strictness of the law, and then there were some who had the view that there was no resurrection. And then there was the Essenes, and their views were still different. And then you had, what's the fourth group? Memory fails me, but that was the military.
Zealots.
Zealots, yes, the military group. That thought they could exercise dominion by their political military.
If you got a digital version, it'd be easier for you to find it.
Pardon me?
So if you've got a digital version, then you can search for it.
Yes, I do have a digital version. So we'll look, and then you can look at the passage if you'd like. Don't let me forget it. So we'll do that. We'll not take our class time for that.
Pharisees not show up.
Okay. It doesn't show up in
the word Pharisees.
No. Well, it's not in the Bible in the Old Testament. Did you look in 1st and 2nd Maccabees?
No, only in the New Testament.
Oh.
It's the word Pharisee.
Okay. But you didn't search these other sources?
I did.
Oh, and it's not there either?
Correct.
That's interesting. Well, we'll have to think about that stuff.
No, they refer to something else. But
okay.
Not that word.
Okay. Dave?
Did possibly Josephus refer to them?
Possibly, to be honest, that wasn't the direction that I had intended for tonight. Let's go back. That's the previous lesson. Go back and look in your lesson book on page 155. 155. And note the second paragraph from the top. It says, "We do not have a record of the origin of any specific sect. We do know that there was an early group called Hasadim, or the Pious Ones. They were very strict in their observance of the law of Moses, and very firm in their opposition to anything that might corrupt their Jewish system of religion. Seemingly, the Pharisees arose of this group." And you might simply do a search on line of the Pharisees, or the other term is H-A-S-I-D-I-N. See what you find. Okay? So you'd have to do a search on them individually and see what you find. But what I wanted to talk with you about tonight had to do with some of the things that caused the Maccabeans to be so zealous in suppressing what the Syrians were doing. You know, when we look at persecution, we often don't realize just how serious that can be. I want to read to you a bit of the history of this period. This is from, if you want to jot it down, 2 Maccabees chapter 7. And it tells us of some of the things that the Syrian emperors were doing. In verse 1, it says, "It came to pass also that seven brethren, together with their mother, were apprehended and compelled by the king to eat swine's flesh against the law, for which end they were tormented with whips and scourges. But one of them, who was the oldest, said thus, 'What wouldst thou ask or learn of us? We are ready to die rather than to transgress the laws of God, received from our fathers.' Then the king, being angry, commanded fry pans and brazen cauldrons to be made hot, which forthwith being heated, he commanded to cut out the tongue of him that had spoken first, and the skin of his head being drawn off, to chop off also the extremities of his hands and feet, and the rest of his brethren and his mother looking on. And when he was now maimed in all parts, he commanded him, being yet alive, to be brought to the fire and to be fried in the frying pan. And while he was suffering therein long torments, the rest together with the mother exhorted one another to die manfully. Now, I don't want to read all of this, just to be honest. It takes a good bit of time, but I would like you to read it. That's in 2 Maccabees chapter 7. I think you'll stand in awe with the strength with which these people faced that kind of persecution. You've never faced anything to compare with that, and likely won't ever. But you read this chapter, and you'll see what made the Maccabees revolt so strongly. Okay? That's enough of that. Something else I wanted to talk with you about tonight, in the remaining moments that we have, is I wanted to talk with you about the next lesson as time draws near. Time draws near. You'll see that on page 160 in your lesson book. Page 160 in your lesson book. And by the way, to those of you who don't have a lesson book, if you could share with somebody, that would be wonderful. I've called the bookstore and they're still unavailable. They're supposed to be reprinting this lesson book, but right now it's not on the shelf. And so the owner of the bookstore is a good friend of mine. He said he would follow up on that and let me know just as soon as he's available, as soon as these become available. But when we look at lesson number 40, on time draws near, it's important that we go back and look at these maps and see how they are changing. When David ruled, how long was it before the coming of Christ when David ruled? 1,000 years. What did God say through Nathan the prophet to David about the establishment of his kingdom? Alright, it will endure forever. That's right. And we know that Solomon built the temple, etc., etc., but we know that 2 Samuel 7, verse 14 through verse 16 is referenced in Acts 2. So we know that that particular prophecy of the establishment of the throne of David has application to the coming of the Messiah. Now, here we read of the divided kingdom when Israel was declared themselves as were independent under the leadership of Jeroboam, who introduced idolatry among them. What kind of a time frame are we looking at here? During the days of Uzziah, Jeroboam. You look on your list of the kings in your lesson book. I don't have that chart in front of me. And see where Uzziah is placed on the king, and then go to the far left and give me an approximate date. Well, you can go back to Rehoboam if you would like and give me an approximate date. About 750? Okay, so we've knocked about 300 years.
750 is about the 50th year.
Okay, about 700. So again, we've knocked about 300 years off from the prophecy made to David. And then we come to this map. And this map we want to note very special, because we know that the city of Samaria, the capital of the northern 10 tribes, fell to the hand of the king of Assyria when? 722. That's right. You may read in some sources 721. But we'll stay with 722 B.C. So that gives you a date, a very near date, as to when the northern kingdom fell. You see that the southern kingdom of Judah still exists, and this exploded map helps us to see, and we've talked about this extensively, the little kingdom of Judah here under the reign of Hezekiah, how that they're still faithful to God, and look at the huge Assyrian empire. And the Assyrian king told Hezekiah, why don't you surrender? All these other nations' gods haven't been able to save them. What makes you think your God can save you? But what was the promise of God all through their history? You obey me and I'll bless you. And Hezekiah at this point was continuing to obey God. And the king of Assyria went back to Nineveh, the capital of the Assyrian Empire, somewhat in shame. What had happened to him? Lost most of his army, 185,000 of them. And then when he got back to Nineveh, what happened to him? Assassinated by his own sons. That's right. And then we look at the Babylonian kingdom, and we see how it has conquered now the Assyrian kingdom and taken the southern kingdom of Judah captive when Jerusalem fell. Now, we know that there were about three sieges against the city of Jerusalem, but when is the date generally recognized that they fell? 586 BC, and they were carried away into Babylonian captivity. Now, this map shows how that the Medes and the Persians had joined forces, and they conquered the Babylonian Empire. Now, do you notice where the land of Palestine, or Canaan, is on all these maps? It's about in the middle, but it hasn't moved, has it? It's still in the same place over here in the eastern part of the Mediterranean Sea. And you look at the larger map, you see it's still there. What has changed? Still there. Who owns it? That's right. Now, why does everybody want to own that? Trade routes, yes. North and south. And, of course, up here at Tyre, you have a seaport. So you've got commercial trade from the sea, from other nations coming through this little part of Canaan. And so everybody wants to own that. And Babylon now owns it. And now the king of the Medes and the Persians own it. And now the king, Cyrus, writes a decree to allow them to return out of captivity, out of bondage, if they so desire. And they can go back and rebuild in the city of Jerusalem. This map indicates that effort. Now, this map takes us just a little beyond that effort to the time of the Syrian Empire. And it was the Syrians' desire to conquer all of this as well and make themselves such a great empire. But they met with resistance. They were not able to conquer all that they desired to conquer. Although we do know that during this effort to conquer the land of Palestine, they met with extreme resistance and were driven back out of the land. Now, here is a map that represents the land as it's ruled over during this Maccabean period. Now, we know that we're getting close. Daniel said these things are going to happen in the last days. And we know that as we get to this Maccabean period, we're approaching the period in which the Romans are going to begin their rule. And it's just fascinating how that all begins to develop. In fulfillment of Daniel's prophecy, during the days of these kings, the God of heaven is going to set up his kingdom, and it's going to stand forever. I got 5 minutes? All right, thank you. Daniel's prophecy is about to come true. At this point, we're about 100 years away. And these things are getting close. The Assyrians were the first to conquer a large empire. And I want to just kind of skip through these because we've seen that on the map. But Rome, as we mentioned, with all of its might and power, is about ready to conquer Syria and make a province out of it, and then come on down through the land of Canaan and conquer it, and go on down into Egypt and conquer it, and then on around into North Africa and conquer it, so that they control everything around the Mediterranean Sea. Now, faithful Jews, they, during this period, would long for the coming of the Messiah. We see evidence of that in the New Testament. When Jesus was speaking with the Samaritan woman, what was it that though she was a Samaritan, she was well aware of? The prophecies of the coming of the Messiah. But now the problem existed in the mind of the Jews and others regarding what the nature of that kingdom was going to be. Even during the days of the apostles, even after Jesus came and was crucified and raised from the dead, in Acts chapter 1, verses 6 through 8, what about the kingdom prophesied in these Old Testament prophecies in the mind of even the apostles. That's right. Will you restore the kingdom of heaven or the kingdom of God now? Will you give it to Israel now? So they still have this mistaken understanding that the kingdom was in some way going to be earthly in its nature. But as time draws near, we know that there wasn't some single military genius among the Romans. This all began to develop. And I want us to see how that the Roman Empire began and how it conquered this land around the Mediterranean Sea. Now, as time draws near, you don't have this in your book, but I want you to look carefully at it. We know that there was a military leader in Rome that engaged those of Carthage in the first major battle of this expansion of the Roman Empire. We know that that was about 200 B.C. We know also that this military leader expanded over into Spain. And then another military leader expanded eastward over into Macedonia, about 197 B.C. And we know then that as this continued, they expanded over into the province of Syria, which before it was a province of Rome. But they expanded over into the Syrians' territory and demanded that the Syrians pay them tax. Now this has always been a tactic. We've talked about this before. How do you suppose the Syrians met that demand to pay taxes to Rome?
Not well.
Not well. No, not well. They met it with resistance. And then what did Rome do? Yes. Notice that the Parthians also had threatened the Syrians. So you've got Rome on the west, and you've got Parthia on the east, and both of them are infringing upon the territory and privileges of Syria. And you see what's about to happen. Now this is just following the period of the Maccabees. Now, or I should say just before the period of the Maccabees. Syria became a Roman province in 64 B.C. What does that tell us? By 64 B.C., who's in power? Rome is. No longer Syria. And it's during this time, I don't have the, yes I do, 167 B.C. in this interim, I got that one out of order, that the Maccabean revolt takes place. It takes place, you see what I've done, let's see, between this period. Or actually, this takes place before this period. This should have come up before that one. Okay? So that's an error on my part, but you see that and see how that takes place. Well,
they're hammering away at Syria.
That's right. They're hammering away at Syria. So you've got Julius Caesar that's going west. You've got a man with the name of Pompey. Sounds familiar? He's going to the east, and they're conquering territory for Rome. Okay? And I'm out of time. I greet that with a great deal of enthusiasm. Out of time. All right. Well, you read this section on the time draws near, the next lesson. I believe that's number 40. And not only read that, but also I've handed out questions to review the Maccabean revolt. And if you don't have these, they're going to be on the table up here, and you will likely receive them via email tomorrow if you'd like to have them on your computer. Just a brief explanation. There's something about my program that won't let me send to such a long list. So I send it to Richard, and Richard sends it to the long list. So that's why you get these from Richard.